We're going to open to Deuteronomy chapter 25 today. Remember that Deuteronomy is a final address of Moses to the Israeli people shortly before they go into the Promised Land, shortly before he passes away. And so it's got quite the mixture of review material here. And because of that, it shifts topic quite rapidly. So chapter 25, verse 1, where we pick up today, says this. If there is a dispute between men, and they come into court, and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty. So we got two people. They are at odds with one another. Something's happened. No details are really given here. But they bring it to court, and the judges determine who's in the right and who's in the wrong. So that's the preamble. That's the beginning of this what if. It says, then, if the guilty man deserves to be beaten. Now, the Israeli people practiced corporal punishment. Punishment of the body. Basically a spanking for adults. It was probably administered through the use of a rod. Now, don't think of like a rake handle or a shovel handle or anything like that. Think more of a piece of bamboo. Back when I was a kid, every once in a while when I got in trouble, I'd get a switching. And what did that mean? It meant typically I had to go and cut a branch off of a nearby tree. There was a willow tree that was very handy for that, and bring it back to whoever it was that was going to administer my corporal punishment. Well, think of this being similar to that. Some sort of bendable branch that is going to be used to administer a spanking to an adult. And this is what it says. The judge shall cause him to lie down. So this is all administered in the presence of the court. The court officials who heard all the evidence and came to the conclusion, this person did something to the other person that is not right, and he needs to be spanked. All right? So the judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence with a number of stripes in proportion to his offense. So the judge has decided, all right, this is a 2 SWAT offense, or this is a 8 SWAT offense, or a 10 SWAT offense. And so the judge would watch as the swatting happened. Now, by the way, it was on the back of the person that was done, probably between the shoulder blades down to the buttocks, somewhere in that neighborhood. And so the next thing that Moses reminds everybody of is that there is a limit that needs to be placed on this spanking. Verse 3, 40 stripes may be given to him, but not more. Lest if one should go on to beat him with more stripes than these, your brother be degraded in your sight. So the idea of this spanking is not to do great harm to the person. It is to impress upon them, through the means of pain, how important it is to recognize what they did to the other person was wrong and should not be repeated. It's not to degrade the person and to do permanent harm. And so 40 was the upper limit. Now, this takes on an interesting aspect in the New Testament. Because between the closing of the Old Testament, right around 400 BC, and the beginning of the stories of the New Testament, which is at the tail end of 10 excuse me, of the BC period and the beginning of the AD period. The rabbinical oral traditions got started, usually associated with the Pharisees. And the Pharisees were of the mind that we need to be very clear what the law intended. And so we need to specify things much more than what's in the actual text of the Torah. They also believed that they needed to put a, as they described it, a hedge around the law. That is, a little protective barrier against accidental breakage. And so during that little time period in between the Old and New Testaments, the Pharisees said, you know what? What would happen if you were administering this corporal punishment, this spanking, and the person who's doing the spanking loses count? They might accidentally give 41 whacks when they were administering a maximum. So let's move it back to 39 just to be on the safe side. So that is why in the New Testament, Paul describes how he, more than once, being punished in a synagogue for preaching about the death and the resurrection of Jesus, he got 40 whacks minus 1, meaning 39. So just a little tie-in with our New Testament story. Verse 4, change of topic. You shall not muzzle the ox when it is treading out the grain. Now, this is something we don't see today because a lot of this stuff happens in a factory setting automatically using machinery. But the harvesting process of grain was that once the stalk was cut down, it was taken to an area that was flat and hard, laid down on that flat, hard surface, and then an ox, typically, although donkeys could be used as well, would pull what is called a threshing sledge across all of those stalks of grain repeatedly. Now, sometimes they'd go back and forth. Other times, they might be in like a circular pattern. They'd just be tethered to a central post, and they'd just go round and round and round in circles with this big bunch of wood with iron spikes underneath being drug across the grain. And that process would break all of the kernels of grain out of their husks, and then the next step would be to winnow them, meaning you'd use wind power to separate the grain from the chaff. But during this threshing process, Moses, at God's directive, says, don't you put a muzzle on the ox that's doing all of that work. Let it, when it's hungry, bend its head down and get a mouthful of grain and straw, because it's expending its energy in processing all this grain for you. Why would you steal something from the very animal that's doing the work? Why would you steal some of the fruit of its labor from it? Now, that principle gets picked up in the New Testament by the Apostle Paul. First of all, 1 Corinthians chapter 9, and then over in 1 Timothy chapter 5, where he is saying that people who are doing the work of the Lord should be paid out of ministry funds. That's fair, because they are expending energy on behalf of the Lord. Any monies that come in to that ministry work, some of them at least, should be earmarked for that person's support, which is actually an Old Testament principle as well, because the priests and the Levites were paid out of the tithe. But that's another good New Testament tie-in to an Old Testament passage. verse 5 has another change of topic. If brothers dwell together and one of them dies, has no son, the wife of the dead man shall not be married outside the family to a stranger. Now, before we go any farther, we need to understand that the culture of Deuteronomy is very ancient to us. And it's not just separated in time, but it's also separated in space. It's Middle Eastern. And so we have a hard time getting our minds wrapped around, I think sometimes, the way things were quite normal to these folks here. So the idea of the inheritance of property was a family concern. You had to know who was going to inherit what. For the Israelis, of course, when they go into the Promised Land, every tribe is going to be given a tribal region, and then all the families in those tribal regions were going to be given family farms, family property. And from there on out, that property would be passed on according to inheritance rights. So you want to keep the property inside the family and inside the tribe. That's what we are concerned about here. And it's even mentions it here that when a woman marries a man and that man dies and they don't have any kids together, then in order to protect property rights, the family needs to arrange for her to get married to another member of the same family. And since the original marriage was probably arranged, then that would not have been that shocking to any of the people involved in this. Again, we live in a time period where most people marry based on their own free will choices. They marry for love or sometimes for infatuation or whatever. In most of the history of the world, in most of the cultures of the world throughout that history, marriages were arranged by families, looking out for family concerns. Okay, back to the text. So her husband's brother shall go into her and take her as his wife. Now, understand there's some assumptions made here. First of all, she don't have any kids from her first husband, so that's the problem. Her husband was the one that was going to inherit the property of his father, and then he would pass on his son, but there is no son because they didn't have any kids together. So the decision is she needs to marry the next unattached son in that family line. So if the next brother's already married, he is not in the running for this responsibility. If the next one after that is engaged or betrothed, he's not in the running for this either. It has to be the next unspoken for son. And once we get to that understanding, then he will perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. Meaning they'll get married and they will start having kids together. Verse 6. The first son whom she bears shall succeed to the name of his dead brother, that his name may not be blotted out of Israel. So the first son born to this new marriage is counted as the heir of the late husband. Now, verse 7. If a man does not wish to take his brother's wife, now, it's not that he doesn't like her. It's the idea here, I don't want to put my own inheritance line at risk. What if I only have one boy with her? Because in this situation, the second boy would be the heir of the second husband. So he might say, I don't want to take the chance of not having two boys, so I'm not going to marry her. Then that's an insult. It's an insult to his late brother. It is an insult to his sister-in-law. It is an insult to the entire family because he is putting himself ahead of the family responsibilities. So if the man does not wish to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders. Now that's where judicial decisions are done. This is the leadership of the community. And she shall say, my husband's brother refuses to perpetuate his brother's name in Israel. He will not perform the duty of a husband's brother to me. So she is making a legal complaint. Then the elders of his city shall call him and speak to him. So basically try to convince him, hey, you need to do this. This is the right thing to do. And if he persists saying, I don't wish to take her, then his brother's wife, because she's here in the proceedings, shall go up to him in the presence of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. Now, the spitting in his face, that is still understood in our culture to be an insult. The pulling off the sandal, that's not Western. Now, we have seen, though, because of our connection through multimedia, that the Middle Eastern culture still has some sort of attachment of shame to the shoe. You might remember that some of the Middle Eastern people got mad at President Bush. I don't remember which one it was, first or second President Bush. But somebody at a press conference threw a shoe at him. Well, they were Middle Eastern, and they were trying to tag him with a shoe as a sign of shame. When there was the death of Saddam Hussein, and people were in the Middle East that were glad to see the last of him, they were going around taking their sandals off and slapping them against portraits of Saddam Hussein, showing their disrespect and their dislike of him, their disapproval of him. So I don't know how the original connection got started, but sandals, shoes were connected with showing disdain for someone. Perhaps the idea that if you put somebody into your shoe, you've humbled them. Because we do have examples of where people who have been conquered have to lay down on the ground, and the victor puts their foot on their neck. So that might be kind of part of the original connection to this. So what is she supposed to do? She's supposed to go up to this guy in the courtroom area, rip his sandal off his foot. He has to let it happen, by the way, because this is court proceedings. And then she spits in his face. And then she shall answer and say, so shall it be done to the man who doesn't build up his brother's house. And then the name of his house shall be called in Israel, the house of him who had his sandal pulled off, or the shoeless guy. So he would bear the shame of that. Even if he gets married and has kids of his own, he still has this shame that follows him from there on out, the house of the shoeless one. Now, this is quite intriguing to me, how things change over time, because this plays a role in the story in the book of Ruth, where levirate marriage plays a key role. Now, levirate has to do with brother-in-law or in-law marriage. And so you may remember the story that Ruth came back with her mother-in-law to Israel after Ruth's father-in-law had died and Ruth's Jewish husband had already died. And So it was only Ruth and Naomi that were left kind of fending for themselves. They were living hand to mouth. Ruth ends up going out doing the gleaning thing that we've talked about in recent days, trying to get enough grain for them to live off of and have a little extra. And Boaz helps in that. He makes sure that his harvesters drop extra stuff in front of Ruth. And so Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, decides, you know what? Boaz is on the list of close relatives. He wasn't a brother of her husband, but probably a cousin or something of that nature. And so the law of that we're reading here was to be invoked for Naomi's daughter-in-law, who was widowed, to get married to a relative. And the only hitch, because Boaz and Ruth kind of fall in love together, the only hitch to them getting married was that there was another relative slightly closer to the rite of redemption. And so Boaz goes to the man and says, hey, you know that Naomi and her daughter-in-law Ruth has come back to town, and they've got a piece of property that needs to be redeemed, and you're in line ahead of me in order to take control of that property, but also you have to marry Ruth. And the guy says, I don't want to marry Ruth. And he reaches down and takes his sandal off and hands it to apparently to Boaz to show, no, I'm going to pass on this. So none of the shame factor that we've been reading here in Deuteronomy 24 or 25 is still in the culture of the Jews by the time that the story of Ruth takes place. That's all been lost. It's just ceremony. And so we all appreciate the fact that over time, ceremony that had a purpose early on kind of gets lost. And so I just wanted to let you know that the shame factor seems to disappear quickly from this. Verse number 11, change of topic. And what a topic it is. And by the way, if I hadn't said it recently, we're in the book of Deuteronomy. It has an awful lot of PG-13 material. So you should not, during through this whole time period, be having little kids participate in our Bible study. Get them busy somewhere else. And so the next part, definitely I have to bring out some PG-13 explicit material. So verse number 11, when men fight with one another, so literally they are in a wrestling match. They are trying to hurt each other. And the wife of the one draws near to rescue her husband from the hand of him who's beating him. So you can picture this in your mind, can't you? It's a brawl. And the wife of one of the two brawlers is right there. And she's probably screaming and yelling. And so Moses says, if she puts out her hand and seizes him by the private parts. So she reaches in and purposefully, she does this not by accident, she does it to hurt the guy. She grabs him by the family jewels. I'm putting it that way, partly to be delicate, but partly to remind you that the private parts of a guy have always been understood to be the members of regeneration or progeneration, the production of a new generation. And so this woman has intentionally tried to damage his ability to have kids. That's the context here. She has tried to interfere with the next generation in Israel. And that is why the penalty can be so very severe. Then you shall cut off her hand, your eye shall have no pity. Now, in this time period, they were big believers in let the punishment fit the crime. And we've talked about how some people would have their tooth knocked out because they, through their aggression, had knocked somebody else's tooth out. Or they might have a hand amputated or a foot amputated because through their aggression or their neglect, they caused that to happen in somebody else's life. So here we have the example of if she tries to jump into the brawl and take away the guy's ability to have another generation, that's serious. And she needs to suffer a very serious penalty. Verse number 13. Change of topic, but very important. Fairness. You shall not have in your bag two kinds of weights, a large and a small. You shall not have in your house two kinds of measures, a large and a small. A fair and full weight you shall have, a fair and full measure you shall have, that your days may be long in the land that he who is your God is giving you. For all who do such things, all who act dishonestly, are an abomination to he who is your God. So you use the exact same standard of measure for everyone and every type of transaction. You don't try to cheat people. And that is the reason why in our modern time period, we have standards and weights that are measured in the government to make sure that everybody is being fair to everybody else. Mark your place. We'll get back here the next time we're into the Word.